When we started on our journey, you know, the thing that was really obvious to us and becomes more obvious to everybody, essentially what we do is connect dots that already exist in people's minds. I mean, everybody knows water is essential. But not everybody's always thinking about it these days. And the dots that connected with us were, when we looked at the industry very closely in 2005, was that it's an industry, obviously, that delivers an essential resource that is non-fungible. In other words, it can't be replaced by anything else. When you need water, water is the only thing that will do.
Yes, folks, David here. Welcome, welcome, welcome all. The Left Reckoning 104. Talking about nuclear power, why Wall Street is very, very interested in your water, and all around why we got to get much, much more serious, not just about the reality of climate change, but what we're going to be doing about it. I'm your host, David Griscom. Our good friend Matt Leck is out on vacation at the time being. Hope that he's getting nice and having a good time, but we're going to have a good time tonight. I mean, I'm really excited for this episode. In just a little bit, we're going to be joined by Madison Hilly, who is the founder of the Campaign for a Green Nuclear Deal, to come here and make a progressive case for why we need nuclear power for the planet, for the working class, and for a more plentiful and greener future. I really enjoyed chatting with her. And, you know, we talk about the positives and we also talk about some of the concerns that people have about nuclear power. If people have been watching the show for a long time, they know I've been a convert on this. And I think that it's something that we really need to be taking seriously if we're serious about trying to decouple from fossil fuels. And a little bit later in the show, we'll be going back to visit our friend who opened the show up for us, Matt DeSario, who is the president of Water Asset Management, a company that has been buying up land near water all across the United States, and talk about why Wall Street is so damn interested in water in this country. Spoiler alert, it's not good. And then in the post game, we're going to be talking about some of the mythologies that the right wing puts forward about the Civil War. Be sure to join us for that at patreon.com/leftreckoning. Well, and just really quick before we get into the opening monologue here, I do just want to let people know we have a lot of really exciting stuff coming up. We have Nando Villa, he's going to be on the show soon with his co-host of the new excellent podcast, Shoot the Messenger, Rose, and they're going to be talking about this new really, really frightening spyware that had a major role to play in the murder of Khashoggi. We're going to be doing an episode on Vietnam. We're going to be covering some really horrifying stuff that's happening right here in Austin, Texas with the police department and much, much, much more. So keep your, keep tuned into Left Reckoning over the next few weeks. And if you've missed them, we've put both of the episodes up from behind the paywall. Matt and I's conversation on Rosa Luxemburg's classic text, Reform of Revolution. We really like doing those theory reading series. So if you've missed those, be sure to check those out. We're going to get to this conversation with Madison Hilly in just a moment. But when I was putting the show together this week, I realized that the stories that I wanted to talk about all had a common theme, and that is how we are going to be dealing with the climate crisis. And there's a lot of stuff that you have to get into when we really want to take this seriously. One, the reality of climate change, and two, what exactly we're going to do about it. Because as you see, Wall Street, the capitalist class, the people in power in this country, all recognize that the climate is changing. You know, some on the fringes still might deny it because it's beneficial to them, but they're all making moves to prepare for a different kind of world. And we need to be taking this threat very, very seriously, and expanding from just being in the kind of contemporary discourse of, oh, the left believes in climate change, to really taking seriously what it is that we mean that we want to do about it. And, you know, being here in Austin, I had an experience with this. If people missed it, we had a pretty nasty winter storm last week and power went out for thousands upon thousands of people. I was lucky that my power didn't go out, but my family's power went out for 4 to 5 days. And, you know, that means there's no, all the food in the fridge goes bad. That means you don't have any ability to heat your home and you really needed it when it's really cold out, and you're stuck. And it was a really strange experience to sort of see a two-tiered Austin, right? Because after the ice started to melt, you know, a lot of people went about their daily life, and then other people were living in really, really desperate situations. And it really was a kind of preview of a very likely future under capitalism with climate change, where there are going to be certain groups who are going to be okay and certain groups are going to be left out to dry. And just to be really clear, because there's a lot of misunderstandings about what happened, I've been very critical of ERCOT. If you've read into my work in Jackman, been watching the show for a long time, you know what I think about the power grid in Texas and all the things that we need to do about it. But this crisis was very unique, because what happened here was, because we had this very quick ice storm, the trees basically got held down by ice. And because there's been prolonged drought in the state of Texas, and particularly in central Texas over not just the past few months, but if you really think about it, over the past decade, all of these trees have really been run through the ringer. A bunch of trees had their limbs fall off and a bunch of them fell over power lines here, which meant that it wasn't so much a grid failure in the sense of we weren't producing enough electricity, but the actual physical infrastructure was not up to the task of producing, of providing power to people in this community. And there are still people in Austin who don't have power. People got messages from Austin Energy earlier this week saying that they might not have power till Sunday. So we're by no stretch of the imagination out of this crisis. And this is a real example of the kinds of things that us on the left really need to be taking seriously. Because if it is things like above ground power lines that can be exposed to the elements and be exposed to fallen tree branches, or if it's the failures of many municipal water systems across the country through the ravages of privatization, like you've seen in Flint, like you saw in Jackson, like you've seen all across the country, it is very, very, very clear that our infrastructure is not up to the task of a changing climate and a changing planet and a growing population. And that needs to change dramatically. There's going to be a lot of fights, rightful ones here, about who is to blame and coming at people who were in positions of power in local government and in Austin Energy who were not prepared for this kind of moment. But when you look at the task ahead of us, they're talking about, and you know, who knows what the actual estimates or the correct numbers are. You know, people are saying somewhere between $12 to $15 billion would be what it would cost to bury the amount of power lines in the city that are necessary to sort of prevent us from having these kind of crises in the future, right? And just knowing the state of not just Austin, but cities and states all across this country, the amount of money, the amount of manpower, the amount of energy and coordination that is needed to prepare this society for a changing climate is going to have to come from the federal level. It's going to have to come from a federal program that is bold enough, not just to play around the edges, not just to give some tax breaks to a couple folks, not just to try to spur innovation in a couple sectors, but actually take a leading role in saying, we're going to weatherize systems across this country. We're going to make sure that all of our drinking water is safe and is accessible to the people and affordable. Right. This is something that we need to be looking at from a federal level, because the fact is that you can't, you're just going to be waiting forever if you think that city and state governments are going to be up to the challenges that are in front of us. We need a real serious federal program to deal with this kind of things. And we're not getting it from Biden. If people watched last week, we talked about the IRA, or as they're calling it now, IRA. The Inflation Reduction Act was insufficient in dealing with the changes that are coming with climate change. We need a real serious movement that takes these things, because these are bread and butter issues. Like, if you're in a community that has recently lost power, if you're in a community that has recently been told you can't drink the water that's coming out of your pipes, that is something that is a bread and butter issue. And that's the kind of thing that us on the left, people who think that working people should have more power, that working people deserve more than they get, and that working people should be able to access the benefits of modern society, like electricity, like water, we need to be at the forefront of these fights. And the only way we can do that is if we move away from the kind of internal squabbles and fighting that we're having and start looking more seriously to working people, labor, and trying to build those kind of coalitions that really reach deep into communities and demand change. Because if we don't do that, the people who are going to come in are going to be the people who want to profit from these failures. And they do not want to deliver better services. They do not want to deliver more resiliency. So these are the fights that are in front of us. And I hope that as we talk about these other stories, we're going to talk about nuclear power in a second. And then later, we're going to talk about water privatization. You know, keep that in mind, that these are the fights that are in front of us. And us on the left need to be much, much, much more serious about building an alternative. And not just, we have to be able to do two things. We can point out that this shit sucks. But at a certain point, we have to move beyond just criticizing and start moving into politics and start changing this shit. Well, folks, I'm going to jump us over to this conversation with Madison Hilly, the founder of the Campaign for a Green Nuclear Deal, to talk about one of the solutions that the left should be upholding to deal with the climate crisis. A little bit later, we're going to talk about water privatization. And again, in the post game, I'm going to be debunking some of these conservative myths about the Civil War and who is fighting in it and for what. You can get access to that patreon.com/leftreckoning. Don't forget, if you're a patron, I'm going to try, and Matt's not here. Matt's usually the one who does all this stuff, but I'm going to try to make sure I can have the phone lines open. So leave us a message at 1-940-289-7234, and we will play that in the post game. But without further ado, let's bring on Madison Hilly to talk about the Green Nuclear Deal. Welcome back, everybody. I'm David, your host here at Left Reckoning. Matt is out. I'm finally getting some sun to make up for the fact that he's been trapped inside in that New York winter for the past few months. But we have a really amazing show for y'all today. A topic I'm really excited to be covering more. As people know, I'm a big nuclear bro, and I think that it's something that's really important. And I think that the left should get a lot better at talking about it. And I couldn't think of a better person to bring on the show to do that in depth than Matty Hilly. Matty Hilly is the founder and executive director of the Campaign for a Green Nuclear Deal. And she's going to be on here to talk a little bit about why nuclear power is so important. Thank you so much, Matty, for joining us on Left Reckoning today.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me on. Excited to be here.
Yeah, well, we're stoked to have you. I mean, you know, we've been covering nuclear power a lot on this program, but oftentimes it's sort of like topic by topic. So I figured, you know, doing a really holistic view of why this is so important is something that I think, you know, our listeners are definitely going to appreciate. And, you know, just talking more broadly, strategy, like electricity is something that is tremendously important. It's what, you know, helps us survive, keeps the house warm when it's cold out, and it keeps the house cool when it's hot out. It cooks our food. It performs a lot of very important, you know, basic functions of life. And the irony is, right now, we really are facing a crisis of not only climate change, but also an electricity crisis. Like right here in Austin, Texas, we've been without electricity for large portions of the city for days. And there's something that, like, it's just so visceral that this really touches people's everyday life, that I think that on the left, like, we need to be taking very seriously how we are proposing maybe getting off of fossil fuels. And, you know, I think that nuclear could be a really big part of that. But you're somebody who's dedicated a tremendous amount of your life and time to the subject. And I'm just wondering if you could, you know, broadly explain to somebody who might be on the fence why nuclear itself is such an important technology for us to be able to power our future.
The first thing to understand, or the first thing I bring up when I'm talking to someone about nuclear, is exactly what you said, just how important energy is. Energy is the lifeblood of society. Increasing energy consumption has coincided with increasing outcomes for education, healthcare, democracy, prosperity, security. So the question is, how do we meet our energy needs without harming nature or while minimizing our impact on the environment? And traditionally, particularly on the left, the conventional wisdom has been we need to produce and consume less energy. And some people call that degrowth. And given the relationships that I just outlined of positive societal outcomes, you have to wonder, what would we be reversing or what would we be sacrificing if we decided to reverse that trend? And that's not to even mention the 13% of the world that doesn't have any electricity access. Unfortunately, we don't need to do that experiment because we are already seeing that countries are able to undergo economic growth while reducing their emissions on absolute terms. And it's a little bit jargony, but that's called decoupling. Mm-hmm. And the basic idea is that through abundant, affordable, clean energy, we can reduce our environmental footprint. So we can make recycling more economical to reduce our need for raw materials. We can desalinate water and reclaim wastewater to protect our aquifers. We can grow more food on less land. So where does nuclear fit into all of this? The key to decoupling is abundant, clean, affordable power. And that's exactly what nuclear provides. Nuclear is the closest thing that we get as possible when it comes to energy to a free lunch. Like fossil fuels, it can produce nation-scale electricity year-round, regardless of the time of day or season. But unlike fossil fuels, it does so without emitting greenhouse gas emissions or harmful air pollutants that impact human health. So from an environmentalist standpoint, nuclear truly is the gold standard.
Mm-hmm. No, and like, I mean, you know, you brought up degrowth, and I think what's so frustrating to me about that whole gambit that folks are getting out there is like, well, we need to sacrifice certain things. And like, by the way, let's be clear about what we're talking about sacrificing. You know, like the ability, again, to like have like very good climates for people to thrive in inside their homes. Things that are like absolutely critical for things like, you know, social justice. Like think, you know, a lot of times decrowthers and people will attack things like washing machines or dishwashers. And the amount of like kind of like tedious labor that has been eradicated by these machines is truly like a world historic benefit for just the daily life of people. And that's something that if you're a leftist or a socialist or progressive, you should want to see being expanded. And the nice thing is that we don't have to make the sacrifice between using less electricity at home and the environment, because something like nuclear power can provide tremendous amounts of electricity, cheap and abundant for the population.
Totally. I mean, I really think that a more just, more equitable society is one with stable, affordable electricity. And anything that makes energy more expensive automatically incentivizes energy austerity and increases poverty. So energy should be a key issue for anyone who's concerned about helping the working class and making sure to alleviate poverty.
And we'll talk in a little bit about how we want to ramp this up, but I think that sometimes people miss one of like the larger criticisms that people who are for nuclear make of some of the other renewable energy sources. And like, I was just wondering if you could sort of help people understand this concept of like intermittency, right? Because I think a lot of people don't understand what, when we say like, when you say that like you can get electricity anytime under any conditions, people might not understand what exactly, you know, you're talking about there, what the risk is.
Right. So society, like the grid, is a balancing act where supply needs to be matched with demand at every second, almost exactly. So the issue with renewables is that the sun isn't always shining and the wind isn't always blowing. So you need to be ready. And we've seen on grids that even have 30% solar and wind that they can go to zero almost instantaneously. So you need to be ready to meet the needs of the grid at any given moment. So that's why nuclear is great, because it substitutes directly for fossil fuels. It's dispatchable, which means we can ramp it up when we need more of it and make less when we don't need more of it. it's reliable. So like I said, regardless of time of day, season, it's actually more resilient than our fossil fuel infrastructure. But renewables do not substitute directly for fossil fuels. And that's because, again, you have this intermittency. Sun doesn't always shine. Wind doesn't always blow. So you would need to either have backup capacity built, a lot of storage, although right now we don't have anything that would be, you know, turned day into night, let alone winter into summer, and a lot of transmission to accommodate that. And like I said, anything that makes electricity excessively expensive increases energy austerity, or incentivizes energy austerity, and increases the burden on the working class. So that's sort of how the technology choices that we make to decarbonize are inseparable from the idea of a just transition and what's actually best to meet the needs of society.
And like, again, to like the transmission thing, I think people miss as well. Like obviously in Texas, we're blessed with the sense of, in the sense of like solar and wind, that there's a lot of parts of like West Texas that are very, you know, that are very ideal for building up those kind of systems there. But the vast majority of the state lives in the Texas Triangle, which means you have to get the electricity from those systems across a big ass state to a place like Austin or Dallas or Houston. And then if you want to talk on the national level, you know, people talk about, you know, Western parts of the country being able to sort of produce a lot of electricity. Again, you have to transmit it versus something like nuclear, which you can put into, you know, has a lot more areas where you're able to put it into. But I want to talk more in a little bit about, you know, some of the benefits for working people and some of the ways we would like to see this get ramped up. But I feel like you can't really have a conversation, a general conversation about nuclear power without sort of speaking to some of the general concerns, because there's a lot of misinformation out there. You know, some of these systems can seem very complicated or foreign or quote unquote unnatural, despite the fact that these are, you know, this is something that does occur in nature. You know, and just like speaking from, you know, my personal experience, and I know a lot of people on the left, like the default position is to be anti-nuclear power. And I think there's probably history for that because of the association with nuclear weapons. We don't need to jump into that history. I want to focus more on the science here. But, you know, I was somebody who was against nuclear power for a long time until I started talking to people who knew more than me, when I started talking to scientists and I started understanding these systems. So I was wondering if we could maybe walk through some of these kind of common questions or concerns that people have. And, you know, I think we, you know, it's fair that we like answer these, but, you know, I don't want to exhaust the entire conversation on these, because sometimes it can be, I don't know, a bit of a distraction and we miss the positive case for nuclear if we're always on the defensive. But the first one I want to start with is the one that I've been getting the most of lately, which is this question of waste. And I think a lot of people misunderstand waste. I know you've said before on other programs like the Jackman Show, I mean, there's always this kind of understanding of this like green goo, like from The Simpsons, is what is produced in a nuclear plant. I mean, could you explain, one, what nuclear waste is, and two, that like the kind of concerns and questions people have about storage and how to process and deal with this waste oftentimes aren't really reflective of like the reality of people who are actually in this industry.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I left college with an environmental science degree and focused on energy and had no idea what nuclear waste looked like. So I'm never surprised when people don't know. So I do carry around a picture of a big fuel assembly and dry cask storage with me, because I think once you take it from the imaginary spot into the real world, it's so much less scary. So nuclear fuel is just a bunch of little uranium pellets about the size of the tip of your pinky, stacked up into a long rod. And then a bunch of those rods are bundled together to make a fuel assembly. And that's what gets put into the reactor, cooks for some time, and then after 3 to 5 years gets pulled out and allowed to cool. And so when we talk about nuclear waste, it's just that spent nuclear fuel. And so currently what we do in the U.S. is we let that cool in cooling ponds, so big pools of water. And then once that's done, we use cranes to put them into what are called dry casks, but basically just imagine big steel and concrete containers. And so the spent fuel goes in there. It sits on site about like a fraction of a parking lot. You can think of a basketball court. Mm-hmm. And in the US, this style of waste management has a 100% perfect safety record. No one has ever been harmed by the waste. No one has, you know, had any, like, it's a perfect system. From an environmentalist perspective, the only issue that I have is that when that fuel is done in the reactor, we've only used about 5% of the potential energy in that uranium. Mm. So in other countries like Japan and France and Russia, they actually recycle their waste to create new fuel. And so that's the problem I have with proposals that are like, oh, the waste is so uniquely dangerous that we need to bury it underground. We would spend so much money to prevent zero cancers, save zero lives, prevent zero hassle. And in fact, we would make it harder to get our next generation nuclear fuel. Mm. So it's perfect right where it is. I've been to a bunch of dry cask storage sites. You can hug it. I mean, most of the utilities require some convincing to let you hug it, but it has happened. So that's how we manage waste. And the idea that it's uniquely dangerous just isn't true. In fact, in the Netherlands, they've turned their central waste facility into a museum that's open to the public. So that's kind of my dream, where these communities that have nuclear plants, that have waste, are allowed to like have local artists paint beautiful murals on it, make it a public park, but mm-hmm. allow people to see it. And I think you'll find that very quickly people are okay with the waste being there.
No, there's a couple more that I want to jump into, but like, you know, again, to be really clear, I mean, do you think that sometimes the way that, like, you know, the idea of, for example, like we need to bury all of our nuclear waste, like deep, deep, deep in the earth, only adds to the kind of general feeling that it's extremely dangerous? When, from my understanding of my personal feelings on this, I mean, that seems like something that you could do to sort of like calm people down, like don't be worried about this, when we should just be making the positive case that this is very, very safe and this is nothing to be worried about in your community. And I love the art museum idea of just sort of inviting the public to be around this and understand that this is a perfectly safe thing to have in your community.
Yeah. I mean, I think it totally reinforces the idea. If someone tells me, hey, it's totally fine, we just need to bury this thing super deeply underground so that no one can ever mm-hmm. get to it, and put a bunch of signs so that if an apocalypse happens, future generations never, like, it's so crazy that it's like, well, God, we shouldn't even mess with that, when that's just so far removed from what's actually true about the waste. I really do think the only people say, oh, the nuclear waste problem. The only yeah. problem it has is that people think it has a problem, and it just doesn't.
And like, again, as you were saying, like the potential of recycling is like an incredible one that it's a shame that we're not utilizing more. Another kind of common, you know, general concern is like, well, I don't want to live next to a nuclear plant because that's going to mean that I'm going to become irradiated and get all these kind of diseases. I mean, you know, what would you say to somebody who had that kind of level of fear about living next to or near a plant?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the understanding of radiation is sort of paradoxical, where we see it as something that's an acute exposure that if you're not careful, you may come in contact with. Mm-hmm. When we are awash in ionizing radiation every day from space, from the ground, from foods we eat, it's seen as unnatural, something that comes from a nuclear plant that is like doesn't occur in nature, which, like you said, fission does occur in nature, when most of the radiation that we are exposed to is natural. And then people think it's mysterious that because it's odorless and tasteless, we don't know what could you know, it could shrink you, it could make you huge, kind of that sci-fi, when really we know more about the human health impacts of ionizing radiation than almost any other hazardous agent. So with this gulf in public perception and what's true, are we just screwed? Like, are we just destined to not be able to manage radiation risk? Well, no, we do it every day in doctors' offices and hospitals around mm-hmm. the world. We understand that small doses that come from diagnostic tests, which are on the same order of magnitude, if not greater, than the doses we're talking about with nuclear workers. I mean, way higher than living near a nuclear plant. Mm-hmm. We know that that's the little bit of increase in risk of cancer far down the line is well worth the information that gives. And in the cases of treating tumors and cancers, even high doses of radiation is worth it. So it's really, again, this public perception issue that somehow radiation from nuclear is uniquely dangerous and we need to avoid it at all costs. I think sometimes in a very technical sector, we get bogged down on the details. Like, pro-nuclear activists love to argue about LNT and like what's the exact model for like describing health impacts of radiation, because they think if we can debunk the model, we're just going to have a massive nuclear build out. Either way, it's so small, who cares? And that message just gets totally missed. Putting radiation into context is so critical, and the industry has been absolute dog shit. Sorry, can I say dog?
No, that's fine. That's fine.
He's been very bad at it. And it's something that communicators are kind of stepping up to the plate to do.
No, and I think it's really important. You know, we have had Lee Phillips on the show a lot. Like, you know, just talking about the regular experience that we all have with radiation. You know, if you're on a plane, you're going to be exposed to some levels of radiation. Hell, you know, my good friend and co-host Matt Leck, who sometimes has a big glass of milk, like he gets exposed to radiation through that. It's like it's something that is naturally occurring. There are levels of radiation just naturally occurring in the world around you. And again, like, are there certain levels of radiation that are dangerous? Yes. But is it something that you're going to be experiencing living next to like a nuclear facility? No. And I will say that, like, I think that it's, as somebody who is an advocate for nuclear power now, it's like, I think that there needs to be a lot more work done to sort of debunk and dispel a lot of these, you know, worries that people have. But I would also say, if you're somebody who's skeptical about this, just look at the nuclear industry itself. Like, it takes all of these concerns like almost too seriously to where it actually hurts our ability to build out nuclear power, right? This is not something that like you from the outside, the first person to sort of think that like I'm worried about radiation. It's like the nuclear industry and even advocates are talking about this constantly.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's another thing where a lot of advocates say, oh, we're like, if nuclear were held to the same standards of coal and natural gas, then we could build, like, they would be way less regulated. And I understand where they're coming from. But at the same time, I went to Bruce Power, the plant in Ontario, and met a former coal worker who worked at North America's largest coal plant who became a nuclear operator. It's an amazing story about of a fossil to fission transition. And he said, you know, I knew when I went to work at the coal plant that I was killing myself, like that there I was increasing my risk of disease, that I would die early if I stayed here forever. And I come home every day from the nuclear plant to my kids knowing that that's a guarantee, that when I go to work, I'm coming home. I mean, yes, it's annoying, all of the precautions, but I'm safe. Mm-hmm. And so I think, yes, that's true. It's, I mean, the hoops they jump through are insane. But I mean, that's a great outcome, is no nuclear plant has ever gotten close to the line of regulation that the NRC and EPA set. And workers are much safer and can be confident going to work because of it.
Could you talk a little bit about the difference in terms of like human mortality in different forms of electricity production, like nuclear compared to coal or all these other systems? I mean, nuclear is like far and away one of the safest ways to produce electricity on the planet.
Absolutely. And I always feel a little weird. I know a lot of nuclear advocates cite, like, you know, 7 million people die prematurely every year from just mm-hmm. typical fossil fuel usage. And I understand where they're coming from, because all else equal, yes, fossil fuels are far more dangerous because they emit harmful pollutants that we breathe in. But if the question is, is their energy or not. There's no question that fossil fuels, having that energy from fossil fuels, has had far more health outcomes and positive societal outcomes than if we were to get rid of that. But if you're just talking about on an equal playing field, where is it coming from? Nuclear has an incredible safety record. In the US, it's perfect. Really, there's one, you know, one, well, actually, let's just walk through the accidents. Mm-hmm. That's helpful. Yes, there are three accidents that we think of that always come up when it comes mm-hmm. to nuclear power. The first, Three Mile Island in the US, a partial meltdown in Pennsylvania. Zero people died. If you didn't evacuate and you lived within the radius of that plant, you got the exposure of about an X-ray, but over a much longer time than an X-ray. So very little would have negligent health impacts, no environmental impacts, no other. I mean, it was a non-issue, except that the industry had such horrible communications that it freaked people out and made it seem like there was a really big issue. The next is Chernobyl. And this is what people tend to think about when they think of worst case scenario nuclear meltdown looks like. This was it. It was an exposed reactor, like core exposed to the environment, on fire, spewing radioactive particles. I mean, my God, I cannot imagine living through it. But we have the benefit of looking at the accident in hindsight after it's been studied for decades. And the UN health report on Chernobyl says that three workers died as a result of the initial explosion, 28 firefighters died of acute radiation syndrome, and 15 people died prematurely of thyroid cancer in the first 25 years after the accident. So with the helicopter crash, 50 deaths. It also says that there could be 145 additional deaths from thyroid cancer, but these aren't immediate. This is like someone who might die at 70 versus 80. And Dr. Jerry Thomas of the Chernobyl Tissue Bank just says, based on these case histories of the patients, that number is probably on the very high end. They're just not seeing these cancers. There were no increases in any other type of cancer, no effect on infant mortality or malformations or fertility, nothing. And so 50 deaths up to possible 200. Chernobyl doesn't even break into the top five energy accidents of the 1980s. Hmm. And then Fukushima, two workers died when they drowned in the basement because of the tsunami, but no one died from radiation from Fukushima. So you're talking about an incredibly small 50 to 200-ish deaths over the commercial nuclear power industry and an incredible amount of power because nuclear is so energy dense. Mm-hmm. So when you get the deaths per terawatt hour, it's so tiny. That even, you know, it's on par with solar and wind, which are kind of a lot harder to track, especially solar. Most of the deaths come from installation. Think mm-hmm. about like
it's really
rooftop mm-hmm. falls or like electrocution, which don't really get counted in the same way. So it's hard to tell. But either way, these are all so small that, you know, the question is, which can reliably power society or not.
No, I mean, I really appreciate you going through that because, like, you know, one, it's like I think it's important to like take those events seriously and to talk about how to avoid them. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I do think that like sprinting too quickly there ignores the conversation that is really important to understand what is the risk that we're trying to avoid, right? Like Chernobyl and Fukushima, let's say, being like the worst in history. What is like the consequence here? It's bad. We don't want to see that happen. But again, like the imagining of like, you know, a Fallout style like hellscape is not really accurate to like what the risks here. So like we want to avoid them. There's a lot, tremendous amounts of work in the industry to avoid them. A lot, as you were saying, like this has been studied immensely. Protocols have been put in place to avoid the kind of things that cause those events. But again, like understanding is like, yes, we take them seriously. Here are the things we're trying to do to avoid them. But also here is what happened in the worst case scenario. Because I think when you let people imagine, we're going to imagine the craziest you know, sequence of events, you know, as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I don't want to be flippant and just say like Chernobyl, who cares? Because I, like I said, I can't imagine having lived through those accidents when there was not a lot of information coming from the authorities in any of those cases. There was a panic, you know, nuclear is still a relatively new technology. So I do think it's better to be cautious and take precautions, especially when you're not sure. But then once the accident is over, and again, we have the benefit of hindsight, it's important to really put those into perspective. And so what you see from these accidents is that even in the worst case scenario, the human health impacts and environmental impacts of nuclear power are just so small. And then when you compare that to the enormous benefits, I mean, it's a no-brainer.
Well, let's talk about some of the benefits. I think, you know, and actually if, you know, we could talk about this later, you could send to me if you don't have any that come to mind. If somebody feels like they need to hear it from somebody else or look into these things, are there any resources that you might suggest people to learn a little bit more about like the safety of these processes?
I have a ton of information on my Twitter and my Substack, but there's also great information at the World Nuclear Association website. Now, some people, you know, feel like they can't trust that because it's an industry association, but it's, you know, completely cited from the UN, World Health Organization. It's all right there. So I would start there as a resource. And, you know, I'm hopefully working on something that is acts as a repository for all of this so people don't have to dig through technical reports or industry websites to get it for themselves.
Excellent. Well, we'll put those links in the show notes for folks who are listening live. But let's talk about some of the exciting stuff, right? So we're at this moment right now where, you know, we are facing a climate crisis. There's a lot of conversation about what we need to do. And we know that, like, you know, we do need to mitigate the levels of fossil fuels that we're burning to produce electricity. In the United States in particular, you know, we had a period where we were building out a lot of nuclear facilities, and that's, you know, ground to a halt for the most part. I mean, sitting here right now, February 2023, what are some of the steps that we really need to be pushing for, you know, to try to get more nuclear power? And also, if you could talk a little bit about the work y'all are doing at the campaign for a green nuclear deal.
Yeah, so I think in the past year, basically since the onset of the energy crisis, are solidly done with step one, which is recognizing that we need a plan for nuclear. I think the volatility of fossil fuels, the invasion of Ukraine, what's happening in Europe has scared politicians in the US. And luckily, we have abundant natural gas, we have coal, we have a lot of room for error. But if we are going to meet our decarbonization targets, we need a plan for nuclear. We need to have that solid backbone of clean electricity for our decarbonization. So that's step one, recognition. But there's a long way between there and, you know, a France or 1970s USA style build out of nuclear power. And I think it could work in a lot of different ways. You know, we've seen it, nuclear power deployed publicly, either in France or through the TVA. We've seen it done by private utilities, often with strong government backing. There's a number of different models that we can pull from. But throughout the history of the industry, there have been key elements to all successful nuclear programs. And I think the two really big ones that would be next for us would be the commitment to a build out. So we can't afford to just build one more nuclear power plant in this country. We can afford to build 100 more, even better, 200 more, but we can't do one-off projects. We know that nuclear costs are brought down by building over and over, by gaining experience, by having established supply chains. And then that gets into the second thing, which is that the most successful nuclear programs have really centered around one or two standardized designs. So right now in the US, we have a lot of different reactor companies and designs and advanced reactors. And, you know, we're kind of treating it like throwing spaghetti against the wall to see what sticks. But really what's important is, what do you have experience building? Stick with it and build it over and over again. The actual design, I know this sounds weird, but I've talked to engineers about this. The actual design is less important than the decision to stick with the design. So that's why Vogtle, in my opinion, at first was a disaster. You picked a brand new design. It's no wonder it's way over budget and behind schedule. But now we have this workforce. We've had the growing pains of building a mega nuclear project, and we're going to waste it unless we commit to building out more AP1000s, training up more crews, using that experience that we learned to build more AP1000s. So, you know, I this is not like from any particular wonky technology preference. Mm-hmm. And I am excited about things like smaller reactors to repower coal plants. But I think if we're really serious, it's going to require a level of government involvement, mainly on planning and coordinating this build out, that it's hard to say if we're ready for, or, you know, it's hard to know if that will be practical anytime soon.
I mean, in my opinion, we need to, you know, to get this out by whatever sort of is available to us. My preference would be to have, you know, these things be federally funded and to build out more TVA style stuff. I think my friend Matt Huber and Fred Stafford have a big piece coming out on that soon. But yeah, because one of the big criticisms outside of the kind of other arguments is that, you know, nuclear power is expensive and it costs a decent amount to start up. But as you were saying, it's like anything. You know, like the first cars were very expensive to produce, but then once you're able to mass produce them, it becomes a lot easier to do so. And if you think about what it takes to build a new nuclear plant today, you got to train the engineers, you got to find the sourcing, you got to build the plants, you got to figure all this kind of stuff. And if we're doing it on a mass scale, these costs go down significantly. But I wanted to talk, like, because I'm curious what you think about the small modular reactors, right? These smaller nuclear plants that you can, as you were saying, just plop down into, you know, a coal plant because already hooked up to the grid. I mean, one thing that I think is really exciting about this is these kind of concepts of a just transition, right? Like a lot of the labor and expertise that went into powering and utilizing fossil fuels could be translated with some level of training over into powering nuclear. And it's one of those things where to those communities that, you know, we all know the problem with fossil fuels, but at the same time, like we had electricity in this country that like was incredibly important historically, economically, and culturally to people. And, you know, to take to those communities where, you know, they're being told, okay, but those jobs are going to go away, say, thank you so much for all the work that you've been doing to power the society. Here's how we can bring this into the future. And, you know, this is why we really, really need you. I think it's something that's very, very politically viable. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that.
Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't have said it better. That's what, you know, you asked about what Campaign for a Green Nuclear Deal is doing. Right now, I'm based in Chicago, and we're working really hard to lift the nuclear moratorium in Illinois. And it's crazy, right? This is the most nuclear-powered state in the nation, and 90% of our clean electricity is nuclear. It's over half of the state's total electricity. We already have the strong
ecosystem. So it's 90% of Chicago?
It's 90% of our carbon-free electricity. Okay. Yeah. And about half of the state's electricity.
So for people who, we have a lot of listeners in Chicago, like if you're living in Chicago, you're benefiting from the system already and you don't need to be scared about talking about building it out anyway.
Right. I mean, and now our nuclear plants have given customers a $1 billion rebate in the past year, thanks to policy we got included in the 2021 energy bill. So you can be even more vocal about it now because people are seeing a little line item that's saving them money every month. But we still have our second largest source of power is coal. And so a lot of downstate is extremely skeptical of what's coming out of Springfield with regards to our energy transition. We're saying we need to shut off 3 Hoover dams worth of coal in the next 7 years So your plants and your jobs and the economic engines of your towns are going to be shut down. And they don't really have a plan for replacing those jobs. Just like renewables don't replace fossil fuels like for like, renewable jobs do not replace fossil fuel jobs like for like. We don't produce most of the solar and wind in the U.S. That gets produced abroad. So really you have installation, and those jobs are temporary and often low wage. They're located outside of the communities. These are not major sources of tax revenues for communities. So how do you expect to get people on board with a massive decarbonization effort if you're taking away their livelihoods? Whereas with coal to nuclear, you can say, we want to allow you to maintain your purpose. We want you to keep being an energy community. We want to retrain so that you can maintain jobs in your communities. We're going to give you an even better tax base. You know, these are generational jobs. This is a long-term strategy. So I think it's a really winning message on the left. And now it's more like convincing kind of older centrist Democrats that it's okay to be for nuclear now and that the winds are changing and it's time to get on board.
But I'm curious, you know, like, so I remember when Bernie put out the plan for a Green New Deal being very excited. And we had Matt Huber on the program last week to sort of talk about what the after effects of the Green New Deal were. And like, there was a lot in it that was very exciting. But I think, you know, one of the most clear examples of why it wasn't successful in the end was that, you know, it really got held up and heralded by like a kind of NGO green left group of people. And the union buy-in was really, really limited. I'm curious, like, if you have any thoughts on like the role for union and organized labor in sort of pushing for a green nuclear deal.
I mean, it was interesting because in the battle for over that energy legislation that I was just talking about in Illinois, one of the issues was that two Illinois nuclear plants were going to be closed prematurely because they were just getting outcompeted in the market by historically cheap natural gas and it heavily subsidized renewables. So the unions came out en masse to just support nuclear power. And, you know, in attending their rallies and working with the leadership, I asked, you know, is this something that you think that your workers, your members in coal communities would support? And they said, absolutely. They wish they had the nuclear jobs because they know it's an automatic 20% wage bump. They know how safe these plants are. They know how good the schools in the communities that have nuclear plants are. So I really think there's a huge political block that the left is ignoring. And nuclear could be that common ground where it brings together the working class, you know, the right, who may not care as much about combating climate change, but really cares about energy security and bringing back big industry. And I don't know, I think the unions, where the unions continue to be strong, unfortunately, the unions just are not what they used to be. They've been really eroded and it's quite sad. But in a place like Illinois, that is the only reason we've been so successful at protecting our nuclear power is because of those unions. And I think that's those unions are why we are going to also lead the nation in deploying new nuclear power.
You know, I mean, you know, I couldn't agree more. I mean, you know, just on the level of jobs for communities, like regardless of its truthfulness, I know, you know, there are different interpretations of the history of Texas and oil, but like for working class families, like there is this kind of understand this is a job you can get and it, you can take care of yourself. You can take care of your family. Again, the oil industry is very, very predatory. And we know all of that history, but even just in people's minds, being able to sort of speak to that in the level saying like, here's the future, you know, industry, power industry, energy industry. And, you know, it provides not only, you know, abundant energy for folks, but as you were saying, permanent jobs. Because when I talk to friends in the electrical industry or IBEW members, you know, they say all the time about, you know, one of the big things that's really frustrating about all the solar deployment is the jobs pay like shit. They're really dangerous. And oftentimes you're getting paid per panel. And what that means for you as a worker is like, you're trying to put on as many panels as possible. Oftentimes people go out there by themselves, which is just like logistically really dangerous.
Right.
You know, because they're getting a pittance for this kind of thing. And there's this green halo around the industry that has sort of allowed it to, you know, do the same kind of stuff that all the other extractive industries do. And nuclear has a potential to really be something that's permanent, high paying, you know, can support a large community. So you don't see these towns sort of just completely get eroded and disappear and everyone has to leave, you know, when the times change.
And that's the beautiful thing about nuclear is it's a lot of highly skilled trades. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of the jobs at the nuclear plant don't require a college degree. So nuclear operator is one of the highest paying jobs you can get, and you can have a high school diploma. In fact, 60% of nuclear operators in the US don't have a college degree. So if we're seeing increasingly more commentary about, you know, how useful are degrees for making your way up in the world, nuclear is one way that you can, you know, the Simpsons got it right in this respect, that through a union-backed job in clean energy, you can support your husband or wife, your children, have a home in the community, and come home safely every day. So I think that's a vision that's worth fighting for.
And I'll just say to the audience here, you know, we're always having these debates on the left. It's like, how do we change the composition of people who consider themselves to be on the left or be socialists or be progressives, right? Because it does trend one way on the education scale. This is a policy that we can all get behind, that we can say with a straight face, with facts behind us, this is a job that is investing in our future in terms of climate change, and also directly investing in working class communities, providing a higher standard of living for working people. And I think that the argument is as clear as day. I know we've went a little bit over, but I do have two quick ones for you, if that's okay.
Totally. Got all the time in the world.
Well, I mean, there's more we're not gonna be able to get to today. It just means we'll have to get you on again soon to do more. But the first one I wanted to ask you is this, is that I'm trying not to be depressing, but there's a lot of stuff out there that is bleak, right? Yes. You know, you do, as you noted at the very beginning, like you look at like the history of a country like France, like that provides like a model for something like green growth, right? Where you can have economic development and have it not be attached to the consumption of more and more fossil fuel, something the degrowthers like refuse to reckon with, that there is like a history of this in a country that a lot of lefties love to praise for other reasons, but for nuclear, right, for some reason, not. But we've seen what's been happening with these pushes in Germany, with what happened in New York City. What happens for the most part when they decommission these nuclear plants?
I mean, it is unambiguous. Everywhere that nuclear is shut down, emissions go up and reliance on fossil fuels increases. I mean, no one has spent more on an energy transition than Germany. Through 2025, I think they will have spent about 580 billion US dollars on renewables, storage, transmission. And they this year have burned more fossil fuels than, or last year burned more fossil fuels than any year since 2018. Their emissions are stagnant and they're not even close to as clean as France is, while France has been, you know, destroying its nuclear fleet for the past 20 years, which is a whole nother story. Mm-hmm. But France is still 8 times cleaner than German electricity for roughly half the cost. Mm-hmm. So, and Indian Point, same example, except even more dangerous because you close down a plant, you know, the arguably the heart of America, New York City, right there at a choke point for energy. And we're seeing in New England as a result of other closures that now oil is suddenly making a big resurgence on the grid. So I think we're in a different position than we were 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. I think it's that recognition of nuclear's importance. And we've seen the Biden administration and other government agencies act in a way to signal this new commitment to nuclear. And we've seen Diablo Canyon is, you know, that's still fraught. They're still working out the kinks, but politicians voted to save Diablo Canyon. Politicians in Illinois voted to save their nuclear plants. But like you said, it gets tiring being on the back foot. Someone's got to articulate a vision for, okay, it's not enough to just continue to wean off of past achievements. How do we do that again? How do we build something that will, that future generations can continue to benefit from?
And look, I'm just going to say this, you know, for people on the left, it's like, we got to be really smart here, because if the green left and this movement keeps on lining up against unions and organized labor, I mean, it's a bad, bad strategy for the kind of things that we want to achieve. The last question I have for you is a little close to home, but in North Texas, Comanche Peak Nuclear Power Plant, its licenses are set to expire in 2030 and 2023 for its two nuclear units. There's a growing push. I don't know about how significant or long lasting it will be, but I've been seeing enough of it to talk about it, to try to push them to not renew these licenses. And, you know, there's been reporters going out talking to folks, a classic story. They talk to a farmer who's very worried about living near a nuclear plant. If you had the opportunity to talk to, you know, a nice fellow from North Texas who had concerns and was thinking that they should maybe try to push to not renew these licenses, I mean, we've been sort of making it throughout the thing, but what kind of case would you make to them about why it's so critical for us to be making sure that we keep these plants online and hopefully expanding them?
Well, I would make an argument of self-interest. And everywhere that we've seen nuclear power plants close prematurely, it has been extremely devastating to the local areas, the towns, the communities that hosted them. So for example, north of me in Zion, Illinois, they lost their nuclear plant in 1998. And that was a yearly annual income loss of $20 million. So, you know, you drive up there and there are empty businesses, empty storefronts, abandoned strip malls. Property taxes have more than doubled. About two-thirds of the single-family homes are now rented out. Many people have moved out of Zion, and they just describe the cycle that's happened where businesses are driven away by high taxes, which increases taxes, and they don't know how to get out from under that. And even more recently, in 2014, Vernon, Vermont lost the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant. And it was devastating. I mean, their emissions, Vermont's emissions, have increased twice as much as the rest of the nation since that time. And they had to have their town budget. They lost, you know, they used to have nuclear engineers that would work as substitute teachers and tutors at their public schools. That was gone. So, you know, again, set aside the environment, set aside the energy security, set aside all of those more abstract things, that it becomes really personal when you say this could be devastating for your town, your community, your neighbors, not only through the direct loss of jobs, but just everything that nuclear plants provide. They truly are economic engines.
Well, I think that's a great case. I really appreciate your time. I mean, could you just give people a quick pitch for the campaign for a green nuclear deal and let people know who might be interested in helping out support the work that y'all are doing over there. Tell them where they can go.
Yeah. So like I said, I was very tired of constantly feeling like I was on my back foot, and I didn't see anyone articulating a vision for what practical but optimistic nuclear growth in America could look like. So I started the campaign for a green nuclear deal to talk about how we can best right the ship to get that that scaled up decarbonization that we know based on history is absolutely possible with nuclear. So we do things like just talk to people about to bust those misconceptions, to make the case for nuclear. We talk to politicians about repealing moratoria, opening themselves up to opportunities from the nuclear industry for their coal power plant replacements. Just basically whatever we can do to help build nuclear, help start building nuclear in the U.S. So right now I'm completely independent of big NGO money or any energy industry interests. It's just my Patreon and like a few subscribers to my brand new Substack, Splitting the Atom. So you can check me out on Patreon, campaign for a green nuclear deal, or Substack, mattiehilly.substack.com. And I would appreciate any and all support because I think this work is really important.
I totally agree. We'll be Left Reckoning. We'll be sure to join up on the Patreon very soon. Mattie Healy, I really do appreciate you taking some time to you know, to chat with me, and hopefully we can do this again in the future because there's a lot of things I think that still need to be said.
I would love that. Thank you for having me on. I'd love to be on anytime.
Hell yeah. Well, that was a Mattie Healy, who is the founder of the Campaign for a Green Nuclear Deal. Really appreciate hearing from her. There's ways to follow her and check out more of her work, along with some more information for people who might want to do some more digging on their own in the future. You know, I mean, like, look, I was somebody who was really hesitant about nuclear power for a long time. And then once I started talking, primarily when I started talking to scientists and when I started talking to union members instead of activists, I really had a real eye-opening moment and started to understand that this is not only a misunderstood technology, but one that I think is absolutely critical. And the really sad thing is that there's been years and years and years of disinformation about nuclear power in this country, and in no small part, in the interests of the fossil fuel industry, because we talked about it during the show. But, you know, all of these greens out there who think that they're fighting for the climate by trying to shut down nuclear plants, well, look what goes there. What happened in New York? They shut down Indian Point and wasn't replaced with the nice renewable energy that everybody sort of hoped and dreamed that it would be. It was dirty fossil fuels. And, you know, if you want to help out the fossil fuel industry, you know, that's on you. But I understand there's a lot of concerns that people have. Again, I shared them for a while, but I can't express enough how important it really is to educate yourself on this and to look more to scientists and union members on these questions versus activists, because, you know, a lot of these things are cultural, these misunderstandings. A lot of the left sort of comes out of NGO concepts, comes out of kind of like hippy dippy stuff. And they have a lot of baggage that comes with it. And I think if you start talking to scientists, people who understand these systems, a lot of your fears will be assuaged. And then you can really jump into something that is a technology that could be incredibly beneficial. I mean, think about all these communities across the country that are really struggling right now. And the ability of us, you know, from like a socialist perspective, to actually be able to do planning and say, you know, this is a community that has a lot of labor potential, has a lot of people who are out of work. We can produce electricity here and power our future, keep people in their communities, keep people in good, high-paying union jobs, right? This is a tool that can certainly be used to decouple us from fossil fuels. And this isn't a pipe dream. You literally can look at countries who built up large nuclear facilities across their country, and you see the potential for actually having economic growth without an increase in the production of fossil fuels, which is devastating the planet, as we all know. So that's my pitch there. I think people should definitely follow Mattie Healy and all of her work. I've been really inspired and was really lucky to have her on. I'm sure we'll have her on in the near future. I have one quick segment to do before we go over the post game. You can get the post game at patreon.com/leftreckoning. Over there, we can decide live if y'all want. I mean, like, I'll tell you, State of the Union stuff is so boring to me, but if people really want to see it, we could watch it together. I have some segments and calls and questions from y'all to do over there. You get access to that patreon.com/leftreckoning. Who knows? Maybe our viewers on Twitch might get a little treat if they haven't subscribed already, but I think you should definitely subscribe if you haven't. But folks, before we get over to the post game, there's one more segment that I want to do, and that's on water. And if people have been watching me from all the way back during the Michael Brooks show days, you know that I've been very worried about what's been happening with water privatization, not just in the United States, but across the globe. It's clear that the ownership class, that the capitalist class, understands that water is a commodity that is going to be more and more scarce in the future. And, you know, I don't even like using that kind of language. I mean, it's disgusting to talk about something that's so fundamental to human life as a commodity, and they reduce something that is a basic building block of human life and natural life into something that should be bought and sold, speculated on, and basically converted into capital, and that has very, very dangerous consequences. You know, as climate change worsens, the question of where we get our water becomes a question not of personal preference, but one of just very general survival. And if this is something that you've been thinking about, you're not alone. Capitalists have been trying to gain more and more control over this critical resource. And, you know, we're going to talk about a very specific example out west. But from everything from just like controlling actual sources of water to getting their hands on municipal and public water supplies, the privatization of water has had devastating consequences for people. Look no further than what happened in Jackson, Mississippi, when it was years and years and years of deregulation, austerity, and opportunities for capitalists to try to make a buck off of public water systems. That created a fundamental crisis where people didn't have clean drinking water. The Colorado River is what we're going to be talking about right now, though. And if you're out west, you know about it. In recent years, it has become drier and drier and has been the site of a contested struggle between states who are all laying claim to water usage for this critical river that provides, you know, tremendous amounts of fresh, clean drinking water for people. Here's a Reuters clip to sort of set up that state struggle right fast for y'all.
This is what remains of the Colorado River. The vital body of water provides drinking water to 40 million people in seven U.S. states as part of a water distribution pact. But in the face of the worst drought in 12 centuries, made worse by climate change, the states had a January the 31st deadline to negotiate their own supply cuts or face possible mandatory cutbacks from the U.S. government. As time was running out, Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming this week submitted a framework to cut water usage. But California wasn't part of it, having broken from the rest of the states to go it alone. Then California answered with its own counter-proposal, saying in a letter to federal officials that the plan from the other states directly and disproportionately impacts California. Some see California's decision to go it alone as increasing the odds the water fight will end up before the courts. David Hayes, a lecturer at Stanford University Law School, is a former top climate aide to President Joe Biden.
We have a situation where some of the water rights holders in California are saying, we're not willing to give up more water, and we think we have legal rights, and we're willing to go to court if we have to. And that's not a solution here. And there's not enough time to litigate these issues. So much is at stake.
When the states struck their agreement 100 years ago, it presumed the river could provide much more water every year than it does now. That shortfall has left state water managers with more rights on paper than existing supply. California receives the largest allotment, most of it for Southern California. Statewide, 80%.
So this is an interstate conflict, and it looks like one that is going to be unresolved, which will have magnificent consequences for all the people in the region. And it's a real moment where you can see the desires of private industry, the desires of private landowners coming up against the reality of climate change. And we need a tremendous amount more of coordination and planning to be able to deal with these crises that we're facing that we just simply do not have. But if it was just like states negotiating and fighting over this kind of thing, that'd be one thing and it'd be bad. But what's really worrying is where you see a crisis, capital C opportunity. Over the past few decades, we've seen tremendous amounts of interest in farmland and water rights coming out of Wall Street. And just want to do a quick shout out to Bacon Cat from the Discord for highlighting this story for me. I want to talk a little bit about this company, Water Asset Management. It's one of these companies that has taken a keen interest in your water. And in Western Colorado alone, they've purchased over $20 million in land. You know, y'all think they're interested in the views and some green chili smothered enchiladas or Colorado mountain pie? You'd be wrong. They're in it to control the price of water. And don't just take my word for it. I mean, here is the CEO, president of Water Asset Management, talking about this 3 years ago on The Impact. And I'm going to play a little bit of this and sort of pause it and sort of put this into layman's term for y'all, because it's a very, very clear example of what these people want to do with a precious resource like water.
We have a private equity team as well that does investing and fund management in the U.S. specifically focused on water rights. So we basically acquire very specific water rights that are used in irrigating what we refer to as low-value crops, and we bring efficiency and transparency to those very high-security water rights, and then we're able to essentially change the permit associated with them, which enables some of that water to go to hot, what we refer to as higher beneficial consumptive users, and that means cities.
So just doing a little translation right there, when he's talking about higher value, it means people will pay more. Right. I mean, let's just be very clear about this. They use, you know, he's utilizing certain kind of language, you know, to make it seem like it's they're just in the pursuit of efficiency and ecology and all these things. It's like, no, who's going to pay the most for this resource that I'm getting access to because we live in a hellscape where a Wall Street company is able to come into Western Colorado and dictate water usage in the state, right? Not rational system, not a system of conservation. Who's going to pay me the most for the shit that I bought? And how can I get as much money as fucking possible from this? That's what is happening now. And you don't think it's going to get worse in the next few years? I mean, like, hell, you know, if it was just the Colorado River, right, it'd be scary, but it's all over the damn country. I mean, the Rio Grande, you don't have to speak Spanish to understand what that river names implies. We've seen it go dry across miles across Texas and New Mexico in the past few years, right? Every once in a while, there'd be a drought, but it is regular and it's sustained. And it means entire communities that relied on this resource in Texas and New Mexico don't have it anymore. Who's coming in is private corporations who are dictating who gets access to it, right? Not out of need, not out of any kind of social planning. Who's going to pay me the most for the thing that I was able to buy? Because again, we live in an unequal system in this country. And, you know, we talk about the inequality in real estate in the United States. We talk about the fact that the vast majority of us are sort of condemned to be renters for the entirety of our life. When we're talking about water, we're not just talking about comfort. We're talking about life and death. And these organizations saying what also when they're talking about high value crops versus low value crops, I mean, what are they talking about? Are they talking about in terms of environmental impact? Or are they talking about in terms of what, how many calories you can provide for people? No, they're talking about what products, what commodities are being produced by these farms and ranches that are going to get us the highest return on our investment. Right, this isn't rational planning. This is pushing us over a cliff that we've already been standing on for way too long. We got some more here. We can keep playing.
Other farmers that might be growing high value crops, industry, energy producers, as well as the environment, which is obviously a key component of the ultimate beneficial use associated with water. When we started on our journey, you know, the thing that was really obvious to us and becomes more obvious to everybody, essentially what we do is connect dots that already exist in people's minds. I mean,
he's going to connect some dots for you. I think you're already thinking what he's about to say next.
Those water is essential. But not everybody's always thinking about it these days. And the dots that connected with us were when we looked at the industry very closely in 2005, was that it's an industry, obviously, that delivers an essential resource that is non-fungible. In other words, it can't be replaced by anything else. When you need water, water is the only thing that will do, which is very unique. The companies in the industry are made up of primarily monopolies that are regulated and generally allowed to earn about a 10% return on equity indexed to inflation that will never really, we don't anticipate ever being deregulated. Because there's nothing that can replace a water utility in a particular service territory. You think about all the disruption.
There you go. We want to be able to sit here and weasel our way into a necessary monopoly-like position so that we can price gouge and do whatever we want. You talk about inflation in this country. You talk about what's happening with all sorts of necessary, you know, commodities when it comes to food. These people want to do it with water. They're already able to do it. And, you know, I know people know about Nestle and all these other corporations. This is not a one-off. I mean, there is a bonanza going on right now to acquire and control the resource of water, to acquire and control the resource of land in this country so that people can dictate to us, the millions of people who live here, their terms and conditions. It's not a democracy. This is just one of those moments where the incompatibility of a democratic system and private property, just they run right into each other. Do you want to live in a world where Matt Desario is able to dictate to you how much water you're able to use, what the price of water is, what organizations, what activities are going to be getting water? Do you want to live in that world? Or would you rather live in a world that we have a rationally planned economy that is able to provide water to the communities that need it at a price that is affordable and is reasonable, right? This is something that it's slow rolling. Sometimes it's not the sexiest story. But boy, this is the kind of life or death thing that you really should be paying attention to.
That technology and innovation is causing in almost every industry. Water is one of the very few industries that's actually benefiting from technology and innovation, but not facing any of the disruptive threats that are facing transportation, retail, all different kinds
financial
of
industry.
Financial industry, all different kinds of industries. And when we looked at that, we kind of put all that together and then realized not only is it one of the most capital intensive industries in the world, but it's one of the least understood industries by everybody here on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange and everywhere else
around
the world.
Hence the opportunity for you as an asset manager.
And then that's when we literally dropped everything and decided by focusing and creating a deep domain.
It's almost over. Just listen to this last bit, because I know he mumbles and talks about a lot of nonsense in between, but this last bit, you know, should be harrowing.
Have now done, it would give us an information advantage in terms of the way we allocate capital. And that's proven to be the case. For 14 years, we've been doing this, and we've beaten the markets for 14 years. We've generated great returns for our investors.
So the translation there is, give us more money so that we can buy more farmland and land adjacent to water so that we can control more of it. We've beaten the market every year. We understand that this is a choke point. This is something that people can't go without. If you watch the show all the way through, you know, at the beginning, we played the clip of him saying water is a non-fungible commodity, meaning that you can't replace water with anything else. Again, like a really unnatural way to talk about something as natural as water. And these are the kind of fights that are in front of us, right? If we're talking about climate change, you know, we know that there is going to be a very, very different experience for working people than there is going to be for wealthy folks. Just here, you know, over this past week, you know, you saw kind of preview. It was random what communities, for the most part, lost electricity here in Austin when the trees fell and knocked over branches. But, you know, what communities got the lights on quicker? You know, there's some discrepancies there. And even more largely in a kind of prolonged experience of unequal resource distribution under capitalism, you know that there are certain communities that are going to be taken care of when we continue to see more and more droughts, when we continue to see more and more crisis in water distribution. And as he said in that video, we tried to reallocate from low performing areas into higher performing areas. And what he means there is, who's going to pay me the most for the shit that I'm sitting on? Something that should not at all be a commodity to speculate on and to play games with. One of the earlier videos we did on Left Reckoning was about Bill Gates buying up farmland. And that's been happening ever since. Not trying to necessarily come at these folks, because there are people who are wealthy and they have asset managers who are telling them what to do. But this kind of like the story came out and, you know, sort of treated as a fun, you know, cutesy story about Joe Burrow and other pro athletes take a stake in Iowa with farm purchases. Some of the biggest names of pro sports, a group including Cincinnati Bengals quarterback Joe Burrow, Boston Celtics forward Blake Griffin, and Toronto Blue Jays pitcher Kevin Gausman, are spending $5 million or buying or more buying U.S. farms with their first purchases coming to Iowa. The coalition of about two dozen players bought the 104-acre North Iowa farm and plan to acquire more, according to Petrikoff Company, a specialized private New York investment firm facilitating the deal. The company declined to say how much the Iowa farm cost, right? And like, look, I'm not even trying to get worked up about Burrow and Griffin and Gausman, right? You know, this is them separating, you know, if we talk about pro athletes and their relationships with the NFL, this is them actually being people with capital, utilizing that capital as a capitalist. But even beyond that, like, these are people who are being told by financial investors what to do with their money. And I bring that up to say, this is what people with money are being told to do. Buy up land, try to get in control of water, try to control natural resources. That's the direction that American capital is going. That's where they see the highest returns on their investment. And that's something that should worry you deeply. And all that being said, the questions of democracy, the questions on, you know, living in this country and globally have never just been more apparent that there are two different realities. There's going to be people who own this stuff and are going to be fine. They're going to make a hell of a lot of money. And then there's going to be the rest of us who are sort of hoping that Matt Desario at Water Asset Management doesn't charge us too much money for water for a municipality or a community, right? That's the two-tiered world that we're in. If you thought that we were already in an unequal hellscape in the United States, it could get a lot, lot worse, which means the imperative on us to get serious and to stop this squabbling and to stop this distance between the left and labor, between the left and communities, and to know that, like, yes, we have a big fight ahead of us. Yes, there's a lot of organizing needs to be done, but we actively need to be doing that instead of getting caught up in all these nonsensical controversies and all these things that suck up so much time and so much attention. Because, yeah, we might not have another campaign to sort of pin our hopes to. And that means it's even more important for people to take seriously the work of building an alternative, because while we're not doing it, they're writing the future for us. And that's not a world I want to live in. Well, folks, I appreciate everybody hanging out tonight. I'm not done. We're going to be jumping over the post game. I think if y'all give me about 5 minutes or so, I should be up and ready. When we get over there, let me know if y'all want to do State of the Union stuff. I have it pulled up. We can watch some of it. I'm just going to tell you, I find that just to be endlessly boring. But if enough of y'all want me to do it, we can do that. I have some stuff on the Civil War. I'll be taking calls and questions. You can leave us a voicemail right now at 1-940-289-7234. I'll be taking Discord questions and all that over the post game, patreon.com/leftreckoning. We got a lot of cool stuff coming up over the next couple of weeks. Be sure to follow Madison Hilly and keep up with her work over there at the Campaign for a Green New Deal. Hope y'all join us in the post game. If not, I'll see all the rest of y'all next week. Take care, friends. Well, that's not it. Yeah, I'm missing Matt, aren't I? All right, here we go.